Welcome to Sustainability Bridges, a Eurosif podcast that aims to build bridges between policymakers, investors, academics, and civil society around the theme of sustainable investment. Eurosif, the European Sustainable Investment Forum, is the leading pan-European association promoting sustainable finance and investment at the European level. In these podcasts, Eurosif's Executive Director invites distinguished guests for a 30-minute conversation on current events shaping the sustainable investment community.
Hello everyone, my name is Aleksandra Palińska and I am the Executive Director of Eurosif, the European Sustainable Investment Forum. For this episode of Sustainability Bridges, I am honored to be joined by Mr. Richard Kolos, Global Head of Social Impact and Human Rights at the ABN AMRO Sustainability Center of Excellence. Richard is also chairman of the Cambridge Institute of Sustainable Leadership Banking Environmental Initiative and chairman of the sustainability platform of the Dutch Banking Association. Together, we are going to discuss the reasons why we need the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, the so-called CSDDD, its essential components, and how financial institutions, in particular banks, can effectively perform due diligence through value chain. Dear Richard, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
The EU Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, which is currently being negotiated by the EU co-legislators, meaning the European Commission, the European Parliament, and the Council, has spurred many controversies. Could you describe to our listeners the main elements of this directive and explain why this directive is an important one to have?
Well, for us, it's basically the translation of the UN Guiding Principles and the OECD guidelines, which are principles and guidelines, and therefore soft law, and that the CSDDD is the translation of those guidelines and principles into hard law. And that is important for us because we've been committed to the UNGPs and the OECD guidelines since 2012. And we try to use that, had to implement them in a proper way, to use that as the guidance for the way we do business. But not everybody is doing that, and therefore there is not a level playing field in the EU. And by implementing the CSDDD, we will be creating a level playing field for all larger companies operating in the EU region, and basically forcing them via hard law to work in compliance with the UN Guiding Principles and OECD guidelines. And those are not the highest of standards. You know, it's basically a minimum level of decent behavior in the marketplace. So, but it is perceived as something ambitious, and I think the ambition is that it's the EU market is a really big market, and we, when successful, we're going to have this level playing field throughout, and not only for the companies operating within or based in the EU, but also any significant company wanting to sell its products or services in the EU. So we're not putting anyone, at a worse position because of this legislation. No, everybody selling their or doing business in the EU will have to be working under the same conditions, and rightfully so, we think.
Thank you very much. Let's now speak about Article 15, which aims to oblige all large companies, meaning companies with over 500 employees, to set and implement transition plans, including climate targets. Do you see this as an important requirement? Also, recently, we have heard that there is a push only to have a requirement to set the targets without an explicit obligation to implement it. Do you think such a requirement would be effective?
Yeah, Article 15 is a very important article because it also connects human rights with the environmental agenda and the climate agenda, because the two are closely related. Any law that, or any directive that says you have to set targets, but they are free of consequences, so it will be a dead letter in your public statements, is an ineffective directive. So everybody and anybody can just set very ambitious targets, but if no one is paying any attention whether or not they are implemented, it's not worth the paper it's written on. The effect of this is, of course, is major. We shouldn't underestimate that. So I remember a year and a half ago, we were in the head office of a global player based in the US, and we were discussing the CSDDD, and when we reached this article, people really were shocked and had to absorb that it was not their board of directors that was determining whether or not climate was a thing to take into account, but was basically the EU. And they were shocked because, you know, despite the fact that they're a global company based in the US, that if they wanted to sell their products in the EU, they had to comply with that. And I think it is important because, as everybody knows, I mean, climate is not a regional or a national problem. It's a global problem. And it would be extremely unfortunate if we would only force companies based in the EU to have a 1.5 degree strategy and implement it, and we would leave everybody outside the EU out of scope. That would be really ineffective. So yes, it has a significant impact, but it the climate problem is a significant problem. So it may be a shock to some people, but those people have then been hiding under a stone or something. And then we're fully aware that it can have and will have significant impact on the way businesses are run. But that is exactly why this regulation is there. This is an integral part of the Green Deal to allow us all as global citizens to reach the Paris Agreement goals. And, implementation is the most important part. Otherwise, these plans are just words written on paper.
Thank you very much, Richard, for these important insights. And indeed, I think it is one of the still, to some extent, controversial articles, even though, as you said, I think, it is sort of obvious that climate change is pretty much exacerbating, and it is a looming, emergency that we have to take care of. And hence, in a way, it shouldn't really come as a surprise to have this kind of an obligation. And at the same time, maybe just to highlight that, still companies would have quite a degree of flexibility, in terms of, setting those targets, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, many people say we already have the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive with the European Sustainability Reporting Standards, but that also prescribe that companies should report the details of their transition plans and climate targets, and there are specific details that need to be disclosed about it. But at the same time, it's still a disclosure-based rule. Hence, if a company doesn't have such a target, it could also just well enough say I don't have it, right? And hence the importance of actually having this obligation clearly underpinning corporate sustainability reporting directive. Would you agree? And would you also have any insights on that?
Yeah, like you said, the CSRD is about creating transparency and basically leaving it to the market to act upon it. The idea, or at least the way I interpreted it, is the transparency will automatically create the actions needed to tackle climate. I think maybe the philosophy was that transparency will be enough and then the market will take care of it. Reality, unfortunately, has shown that we cannot leave it to the market because short-term profits are still, the way the market is run. And you may be right in the long term, but, any investor can jump in or out of stocks at any moment. So even though companies are really creating long-term value, they may be punished in the short term because of market dynamics. And I think the big shift with this CSDDD is that, it makes very explicit that it's not just the market and given the transparency that the market will make the decision, but the decision is put back in the hands of the rule makers. The surprise might also be part of the fact that this directive is called due diligence directive. So people thought it was just about the value chain, just about, doing due diligence. And then suddenly Article 15, hidden in a sub-article, there is this big hammer that says, thou shall have a climate strategy, and we're going to hold you accountable for the execution as well. So maybe people were taken by surprise, but you know, if you zoom out and look at the Green Deal and you look at the Paris Agreement, this is a very logical and integral part of it. So yeah, and it, you know, it's a big change. So, and it's very logical that people have to get used to those changes, but it's a change for the better. And you know, if this get properly implemented, then 20, 30, 40 years from now, we'll look back and say this was a major step in the right direction. And thanks to this regulation, you know, the damage done to the economy, to society, and to the climate is less severe than it would have been otherwise. So it's a remarkable moment in time.
Thank you. Now, touching upon another fairly controversial point, what are your views about the provision aiming to set a behavioral incentive by linking a proportion of directors' variable remuneration with climate targets?
Yeah. It's codifying and kind of formalizing something that is happening in the market already. We see linkages to climate targets already in also US companies and elsewhere, but it's all on a voluntary basis. So you see the front runners doing this already on a global scale. And it is, I think, an underpinning of the fact that, you know, the importance, the materiality, and the double materiality of all this. So if it's material for the company and a material for the long-term success of the company, it is logical to link it to the variable remuneration of its directors. It would be odd maybe not to do it. I guess it's a matter of taste whether you say, well, let's do it voluntarily because, you know, it's so material that, you know, we have to do it anyway. It's a bit more, you know, enforcing to make it mandatory. But I think the actual effect in the market would be very similar. Whether or not you make it compulsory, I think a couple of years down the road, every company will have this link to the director's payment of variable remuneration because it has such a big effect on the company's performance in the market as well as towards society.
Thank you. Now let's move on to the scope-related question. Do you think it is important to include financial institutions in the scope of this directive?
I think it is. I think it's very important for two reasons. One is, I mean, like I said in the beginning, you know, we're already committed to the UN Guiding Principles and OECD guidelines, as almost all major financial institutions already are. So, you know, we're already doing this, but it's on a, and the ones not doing it are being rewarded in the market right now because they can cut corners. So let's create the level playing field at the level where it should be. And that is to make it hard law, because then basically the ones that are already doing it are not penalized by those that are not doing it. So I think it's a very logical step. And the second reason is that if we are included in a proper way, then we can also better help our clients, because a lot of our clients are going to be affected by this. The larger companies, because they themselves are subjected to this legislation, but also smaller clients, SME clients, because if they provide services and or products to larger companies, they will get the same questions from those larger companies. Say, please provide the necessary information that your value chain is proper. And we can provide, especially those SMEs, we can provide really additional services to them to give those insights. Because I don't know any company actually that has more substantial sustainability teams than the major banks. So, you know, we banks have all the expertise in-house to facilitate larger and smaller companies with value chain analyses, you know. And it's actually, we're doing that to a certain extent already in our KYC procedures. We are analyzing, but that's just the company. But if we do, for example, if we provide the payment services for our corporate clients, we can see who they are paying. So we can see their value chain and we can see from whom they receive money. So in a very easy way, and we've already experimented with that, we can just analyze the value chain, both the supplier side as well as the buyer side. We can just very easily digitally analyze you know, those value chains and provide those insights and those reports to our clients and take away a lot of the, let's say, the burden of doing that, because many corporates, but also, of course, even more SMEs do not have human rights experts. We have them, and we love to service our clients and help them in this transition. Yeah, that's easier if we are included in under this directive.
Thank you. And would you have any further practical information on how can financial institutions, and in particular banks, effectively perform environmental and human rights due diligence?
Well, further to what I already said, you know, we have the oversight, we have the insight, we know all the payment flows, and everybody, you know, if it's basically follow the money. So if we are in the best position to follow the money, and given that we have these broad portfolios, we are large enough to have the expertise in-house to assess them, and we are completely used as a result of the implementation of the UNGPs to do these due diligence processes. Now we do them only for our own account and for our own due diligence assessments, but we share those with our clients, but it's really about, you know, for those who are interested. And now we can, you know, beef them up, because let's also be honest, if you move from soft law to hard law, you have to, you know, beef things up. You have to assess where it's not up to par yet. But we can provide those insights, those oversights, but also best practices, for example, in the market. We already started that to a certain extent for specific sectors. For example, we analyzed, everybody knows that the value chain of solar panels is tainted by forced labor, because almost all components come from one source, and there are very significant allegations of forced labor, etc., you know, supported by UN analysis and etc. And we are in an active discussion with the hundreds of solar panel installers, SME companies, on, you know, this is an operational risk for them, because a ban on solar panels, you know, an import ban could take place, like it happened in the US, or under this new under the CSDDD, they might be held liable or accountable for installing a product that is tainted by forced labor. They can't act on that. They are, you know, SMEs are vulnerable in that sense. But by joining forces with them and saying, okay, you can't solve it. I mean, we can't solve it, but jointly we can address it, for example, in Brussels, and say, hey, this problem is too big to handle for an SME company. This has to be addressed in Brussels. It has to be aligned. You can't say, you know, you can import a product without any problem, and then, but the moment you use it in your production process or you install it on the roof of a client, suddenly you become liable for the forced labor in the value chain. So, you know, that's how we are proactively already working on this. And, you know, we get very positive reactions from these companies. And some say, you know, I didn't know this and I wasn't aware. And I'm shocked by this, because I do not, I thought I was selling a good product, you know, helping the energy transition. And now I realize there is a human downside to this. And what can I do? And, you know, do you have examples of best practices of, you know, are there alternative suppliers that I can work with, etc.? And, you know, others were aware, but, you know, couldn't really act on it. And now we're providing, you know, a channel to act. So, and of course, this is not unique. There are many value chains with darker sides to it, with either environmental or social issues attached to it. And, you know, this legislation allows us to act upon it more effectively.
This is really great stuff. And, you know, maybe touching upon also additional aspect that has been raised many times in this very context is, I think some people are afraid, what would it mean, you know, for the, well, contractual situations, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say you already have a contract mm-hmm. with, let's say, a solar panel provider in China, and mm-hmm. suddenly you become aware, okay, there mm-hmm. is, you know, this kind of a risk. How do you deal with this situation? So based on what you explained, I understand mm-hmm. first you will try a dialogue. Okay, what happens if, let's say, the solar panel provider would say, okay, look, this is how it is?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is not a new discussion. So because of the basically the ban in the US, you've already seen a huge effect. You've seen production being being reallocated, production being sourced from other countries. So there are real alternatives created because if the US blocks your products, that is a big thing. So we are in that way lagging behind in Europe. And blocking, if there is an unpopular measure, but what we can do and what we are doing is kind of making sure that there are alternatives, because it makes no sense to apply pressure, whether it's legal pressure or other pressure, to an SME client if there are no alternatives. And at the end of the day, only very few clients of theirs are willing to pay 20-30% extra for solar panels, which are not tainted by modern slavery and human rights abuses. So they are in the squeeze. And when there's a threat, but you don't have a real option to change, you should be helped and not put under pressure. So we take that approach. Because it's it's difficult enough the markets these companies operate in, and that's why we basically says, how can we join forces to address the issue at the level where it must be addressed, and that is not your level, because an SME can't solve this and can't engage with such suppliers, which are billion-dollar companies. That doesn't make any sense. Basically, it depends on the situation. If there are true alternatives, you can apply pressure. But if they're not, you should really focus on helping them and reducing their operational risk, reducing their, help activate alternatives.
Thank you, Richard. And now maybe shifting for a second with regards to situations where, banks provide loans, right, for mm-hmm. some ventures, activities, projects. And let's say that you already provide a loan. I mean, of course, mm-hmm. I guess there is always a possibility to also add certain stipulations, right, mm-hmm. prior to mm-hmm. signing the loan, saying, okay, you have to make, following conditions. But what happens if eventually, you find out at some point that, there might be somewhere a breach, or for instance, mm-hmm. let's say it's already a contract or a yeah. loan that in this yeah. case, has been already longstanding. How do you deal with this kind of situations?
Yeah. This is a very, regular thing. This is something we've been working on and with for decades already. I mean, it started in the 90s, but... And yes, it started with export and project finance, which I happen to be working in previous roles. But to make assessments on the human rights and environmental impacts on projects is really 20, 30 years old already. The Equator Principles were initiated like in 2002 or something. But also for corporate loans. I mean, we've been engaging with clients for a long time. And, things can go wrong. Things we shouldn't be afraid about that things go wrong, because in daily life and in business, things not always go as you plan them to go. So the first, it's about the willingness and ability to adapt. And if a company is not willing to adapt, then it's a really red flag. And then you should eventually be willing, as a bank, you're like, hey, if this company is not willing to adapt, how future-proof are they? How will they perform also financially in the future? Because if you're not willing to adapt, then the context is changing with this legislation as an example. But in general, the context is changing. And if you're not willing to adapt to your context, you're not a good business. So if they're not able to adapt, then you go into the help mode again, and it could be financial help. Maybe investments need to be made to adapt that they, have trouble financing. Then you should really provide the helping hand. But if they're not willing to adapt, then effectively it's about, okay, your decision as a banker is, are they going to end up via, your distressed debt department? Or are they going to end up, the relationship in a more gradual way with less pain? That's basically the decision that's on the table, because sooner or later, companies that are not willing to adapt to their environment will fail. And that's for us to have this this really good long-range radar and to have that conversation with companies like, okay, who are, which are the ones that are willing to adapt to these new situations and act upon that.
I think you're raising very important points, and something that, you know, sometimes might be also forgotten is that indeed sustainability risks, they actually pose, may pose real financial, I would say, consequences, risks to the company, right? And that due diligence, it's not only about, you know, thinking about the impacts on the environment or society, but it's also about actually considering the sustainability risks. Yeah. And also thinking about it, that impacts also in the mid to long term, they can turn into sustainability risks.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, of course, you could say it's preferable if parties act upon it for the greater good and for society, etc. But, you know, if you're not convinced by that argument, then do it for yourself. Do it to protect your own balance sheet and your own P&L, etc. You know, I don't care why you do it as long as you do it. So, you know, and only looking at financial numbers will, you know, that's a good estimate of the performance of a company in the next 12 to 18 months. But it's the non-financial data, the ESG data, that is going to tell you something about the longer term performance of a company. And that's why I use these words like future proof and future readiness, because bankers understand that. They might not be familiar with the ESG lingo, but they do understand future proofness and future readiness. And they just want to serve clients that are future ready, and they want to help their clients to become more future ready. That is very close to their heart. So if we translate it in those words, then we see that, you know, more people, you know, understand what this is about and want to act upon it.
Thank you. Now, one more question, which you have already answered to quite an extent, but as this is also a hot topic right now, maybe just to clarify what your views are on that, should due diligence requirements cover both upstream and downstream value chain?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for us, it's it is not a very difficult question, because like most of our policies is about who do we lend money to and under which conditions. So it's already about our upstream. And, you know, our procurement, of course, for a bank is often not that interesting. It's where the money goes and not and how you spend your money on your IT or your office, etc. And that's also where I see that we have been able to add a lot of value towards our clients, because we have clients, you know, that are considering projects or activities in very difficult countries where the governance is very poor. And they come to us for advice, you know, how should we act upon this? Because there is this, for example, it might be things like, oh, there is a service fee or whatever, you know, euphemism is used to make facility payments, to have bribes in certain countries, you know, and they are like, you know, we don't want to act in this environment, but we do want to do business here. How do, so we can really provide also ESG and other support to clients about who they are selling to. And of course, you know, things like the most obvious examples and the kind of the oldest policies that all financial institutions have in place are like defense policies, and those are controversial weapons. So it's all about who you're lending your money to, or where the money you're investing is invested in. So for us, it's not that big of an issue. But I understand that for some companies, it's like a new chapter, or there's, you know, you can always come up with examples, individual examples, where it's very hard or very difficult to, you know, to track and trace, or, you know, there is a spot market in between or something. But I think in general terms, it shouldn't be an issue.
Thank you. Now, going back for a second to, in a way, the scope also of this directive, I mean, this directive is largely about the due diligence obligations covering covering environment and human rights. Mm-hmm. However, the peculiar bit, despite actually the focus of Article 15 on climate, is, well, that actually some question whether climate should be part of the environment whenever talking about due diligence. I mean, Does it make sense for you? And do you think climate should be included in the environmental due diligence?
Yes, I mean, you could say climate is usually about, let's say, local context. So, for example, local biodiversity or those kind of things. And those are really, you know, location-specific things. Eh? If you operate, let's say, in an area with mangroves, you know, it's completely different than if you operate in a desert. But it doesn't matter, you know, if you emit an enormous amount of carbon while being based in an area with mangroves or deserts. And that negative effect, for example, of the on the climate agenda, on pure the carbon emission, might completely override any work you're doing in, you know, supporting the local habitat or something. So it's just part and parcel of the bigger problem. You can't just pick and choose saying, you know, oh, I don't want this problem to be addressed because I don't like that. No, the problems are there and they have to be looked at in an integrated way. It's not for nothing that all the hundreds of lawsuits globally taking place against companies and governments, most of them actually, you know, they're climate lawsuits, but they are being legally addressed via human rights. So also the most visible lawsuits are all about the fact that there's an infringement on the human right of a livable planet. So they are, even in legal terms, they are interconnected.
So I gather that you strongly believe that climate should be part of the environmental considerations as part of this directive.
Yeah, I mean, and both should be addressed. And I'm not particularly like, okay, they must be integrated in the legal way, but you can't have one left out. It must be looked at it in an integrated way. And I'd like to go further, you know, the social part, the human rights part, and the climate part, and the environmental part should all be looked at it in an integrated way. Because, you know, sometimes they are very tough dilemmas, because what might be good for climate might hurt people, et cetera, et cetera. So you really have to look at these things in an integrated way.
Thank you. Now, let's talk about legal liability. Should directors be responsible for the key provisions in this directive? Yeah. Some business organizations continue to express their concerns about making directors responsible for setting and implementing climate targets, fearing potential lawsuits. Do you think this is a valid concern?
Yeah, well, I'm not a lawyer by training, but I do listen to our legal advisors and our legal departments. And you know, they can explain it to me. So the way they explain it to me, I'll replicate, is that, like, look around you, how many lawsuits there already are against companies and but also even governments that do not have set these targets, etc. So the legal liability is already there. There's more than enough legislation to hold directors accountable. If parties are only afraid of legal liability as a result of this particular directive, then they haven't studied the law properly, because they are already liable today, regardless of the setting of new targets, etc. And in a similar way, the personal responsibility as leaders of a company, that has been, I think, there for a long time. If there's gross misconduct, is there with gross negligence or willful misconduct, you are already liable as a director today in all respects. And if you are grossly, willfully misconducting and grossly negligent on something as material as human rights or climate/nature, then that can be addressed. And it is being addressed in courts already.
Thank you. And indeed, I think, you know, something that has been quite prominent in the debates now for several years is that, well, with the growing importance of sustainability performance, it is important to put sustainability and financial performance on a more equal footing. I mean, I think in this kind of situations, it's also worthwhile to think about the fact that in terms of financial performance, companies have been setting various targets and objectives, you know, and planning their budgets for years, and that the bottom line is, you know, they don't necessarily always meet them, but as long as they can actually explain the steps that they made in order to achieve and explain, you know, the reasons for not meeting these targets. I think, you know, at the end of the day, there is nothing to fear, right?
Yeah. No, very, very true. So, those who are, behaving properly have nothing to fear. And if you are in a position where you're not sure if you're behaving properly or you know that you're behaving improperly, then that is the problem, not the legal liability.
Great. Thank you, Richard. To conclude, what would be your main recommendations to EU policymakers actively working on finalizing this directive and to financial institutions, in particular banks?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's an historical moment. Eh? This is especially the part where we say companies must have and implement a 1.5-degree strategy. It's an historical moment. It's a historical decision that we will look upon favorably in the decades to come. You know, of course, you could say this decision should have been taken 10 or 20 years ago, but then today is the next best thing. It would be very strange to leave out an important sector as the banking sector to say, well, you're not relevant for this, because let's face it, money makes the world go around. And banks are financing the real economy. So banks are financing, you know, our scope 3 is the scope 1 of our clients. So if our clients are bound by this, then we can be bound by it as well. There should be no fear. Yes, of course, it will require implementation. But if you've been, you know, working on climate, as almost all European banks have, if you've been working in line with the UN guiding principles, you know, the step needed to comply with this legislation is rather limited. So, and it's actually, life is becoming way easier if everybody's held by the same rules. And if we do not have to rely on national legislation where for every country, different rules apply. And you know, you have to, especially in bank syndications or something, you have to, you know, the German banks have to do something else than the French bank or the Dutch banks or the Danish banks. That would be very messy, very expensive. So let's join in supporting this European legislation. And we're already seeing that these legislations are being copied in Asia and other regions. So this is really something that's going to be a global standard pretty soon. And it's a historical moment. So, you know, gather your gut or your leadership and gather whatever power is needed to approve this. And let's move forward and let's start implementing. Let's put our energy in that. That would be my advice. And financial institutions, it's like, see the opportunity that this brings. See the opportunity that you have to add value to your clients because of your position in the market. And you know, helping your clients with the transition is in some form or shape part of the strategy of almost all European banks. And this is the way to execute it.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Richard, for joining us today and for this very insightful conversation.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.